V'yokam melech chadash ha-mitzrayim, a new king rose over Egypt, asher lo yadas Yosef, who did not know Yosef. With this pasuk begins the enslavement, the shibud. The Jewish people have been in Egypt as princes, as welcome guests, and now it changes, and now from that honor and position, they're now put into the position of being slaves. But it begins with one step. A new king comes over Mitzrayim who does not know Yosef. Now Rashi and the other Rishonim are bothered by the fact that it can't be. It can't be that this king didn't know Yosef. Yosef was the ruler in Mitzrayim for 80 years. Yosef was a figure of extraordinary importance and significance, and it doesn't make sense that this man didn't know Yosef. Explains Rashi, Asa atzmo kilo lo yada. He made himself as if he didn't know. Of course, he very well knew who Yosef was, but he eradicated in his mind's eye, in policy, he pretended as if he didn't know Yosef. And Adas Zakenin brings down the Medrash exactly what happened. The Jewish people were increasing. Their population were growing exponentially, and it was clear that soon they would outnumber even the Egyptians amongst whose land they lived. And the people in Mitzrayim, the Egyptians themselves, were very much troubled and very much bothered by this. And they come to Paro, and they say as follows, look at the birth rate, 6 per woman. Look what's happening. Very shortly, there's going to be an enemy who attacks us, and very shortly, they will join the enemy, and they'll kick us out of Mitzrayim. We must do something about this. To which Paro responds, how could you say this? Fools, don't you recognize the debt that we owe to Yosef? He was the one who saved this entire land. He was the one who had the wisdom to say, put away the food for 7 years of plenty so that we'll have what to survive on during famine. It's because of him that we now exist. How can we pay back his people, his children, badly? And while Paro made a very impassioned speech, and his point certainly was logical, his people were not impressed, and they deposed him. They took him off his throne, and the Midrash tells us for 3 months he was a commoner. And for 3 months he resisted, and finally he said, okay, whatever you want, I'll do. And this is the Melech Chadash. It's not a new king, it's not a king who wasn't the king before, but it's a new king in the sense that now he made himself like he didn't know Yosef. He agreed to the plot. He agreed to do bad to the people who were the children of Yosef. And in that sense, he is a new king. And what does it mean, asher lo yadas Yosef? It means very simply, in his mind's eye, in terms of his attitude, he ignored all of the good. And then the Das Kingdom goes on to bring another step. He says that Hashem says, I want to give you a mashal. What he did is comparable to the following. Imagine that a man begins stoning the statue of a king. The king sees this and tells his guards, kill that man, hang him. Today he's stoning my statue. Tomorrow it's going to be me who he throws stones at. Says Hashem, look what this man did. Today he says, I don't know Yosef. Today he pretends not to remember Yosef. Tomorrow he's going to say, Mi Hashem, Asher lo yadas et Hashem. Hashem says, this man is going to be trouble. And in fact, that's what happens. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro, says, Paro, Mi Hashem, who is this Hashem? I've never heard of him. And that's how the Das Kingdom explains these psukim. And I believe that there's a rather obvious question on this Das Kingdom. And that is that the mashal doesn't fit and the point doesn't fit. You see, it's clear that Paro is a man who recognizes the good. When his people come to him with this plot to enslave the Jewish people, he says, how can we do that? We owe a debt of gratitude to Yosef. Now, it's true that he gave in because of political pressure, because he was deposed. He gave in and eventually he said, okay, let's ignore the good. But how does Hashem then say he's going to then come to deny the good he owes me? because what he did to Yosef, it's clear that he's going to deny Hashem. Why would that be true? This is a man who actually has great amounts of gratitude. He resists for 3 months. Finally, because of political pressure, he agrees to forget that particular good that Yosef did. But why would that lead him to forget the good that he owes to Hashem? Why would it lead him to deny Hashem? To Yosef, he wanted to deny the good because he had a vested interest. He wanted to remain king. But there's no such vested interest vis-a-vis God. Just because he denied the good to Yosef, why does it mean he would deny the good that he owes to Hashem? Why would it lead him to deny Hashem? And I'd like to see if we can understand what exactly this Nazir Kingdom is telling us, what this Medrash means. And to do that, let's focus on something that I consider very interesting. In our religion, we have many, many, many commandments, 613 of them, 248 positive, 365 negative. And here's the question: what in the world do we need so many mitzvahs for? Listen, if the Torah wants me to grow, the Torah wants me to accomplish, okay, I need a few, I need many, some, but 613 separate mitzvahs? And if that's not enough of a question, why is it that so many of the mitzvahs have to be done so often? Every day we read Shema twice. Every day we daven three times. Tefillin we put on every day. Tzitzits we wear all the time. Every doorpost has a mezuzah. We make 100 brachas a day. There are 19 separate mitzvahs reminding us over the fact that we left Mitzrayim. Who in the world needs so many mitzvahs, so much repetitions, again and again and again and again? After a while, you get it. A few mitzvahs, maybe a few times a year, but who needs all of the multitude of mitzvahs, and who needs to constantly do them all the time? And to understand why, in fact, the Torah gives us these commandments, let's focus on how human beings are influenced and how they're affected. My father was born in Germany. And as a Jew growing up in Germany, he watched very closely the rise of the Nazi party. And I remember my father once explained to me that when Hitler came to power, there was something that didn't make sense. They read in the papers that Joseph Goebbels was appointed propaganda minister. Now, Goebbels was an important person in Hitler's rise. Goebbels was a very influential person and was a person that Hitler owed great favor to and that Hitler respected. And it didn't make sense why he made him something like a propaganda minister. It was kind of like giving him the job of being the head of the post office. And my father explained it didn't make sense. And it wasn't until a few years later that people began to understand that propaganda minister was not a small, irrelevant position in the Nazi party's ideology. It was a center and very real, pivotal position. Because what Hitler was doing was changing the Weltanschauung, changing the world outlook of the German people. And his philosophy was very simple. Tell a lie big enough and often enough, and people will begin to believe it. And as a machine, the propaganda began being emitted through the papers. We had the Stürmer, you had the radio, you had constant speeches. And Germany became a propaganda machine, and it was spurning out so much material. And in fact, it had a tremendous, tremendous effect. Not every German became a Nazi party member, but it changed the reality of German people as a whole, and it definitely allowed Hitler to do what he eventually did. Now, I want to ask you a question. What if you were given the job of Minister of Propaganda? Right? Imagine for a minute you live in the time of powerful kings, and imagine this king appoints you to be the propaganda minister, and he gives you the job of, I want you to start spreading the word of whatever it may be. Not a Nazi party ideology, but his own personal whatever. And you began doing this. You began writing and you began speaking. Now, obviously, your words would influence other people. Obviously, if you were an effective communicator, other people would believe your lies. The king is this, the king is that, the king is such and such. But what about you? You know it's false. You know it's not true. what would happen to your own belief system? And the Sefer HaChinuch explains to us something very, very profound. He says in one of the mitzvahs about remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, one of the mitzvahs is not to break an etzem, not to break a bone when we eat the Korban Pesach. And in that mitzvah, he explains why it is that there are so many mitzvahs reminding us about the fact that we left Mitzrayim. And he says the word, Da ki adam nifal kefi pu'losav. You have to know that a man is affected by his actions. The actions that he does, the words that he speak, affect his feelings, affect his thinking. And after his actions, his heart are pulled. And he says exactly this point. He says, if a man is a tzaddik gomer, a total perfect tzaddik, and his heart is really pure, and he follows every one of the mitzvahs, but he's given a job. Let's imagine the king forces him to be the propaganda minister. And in that position, he's forced to lie, and he's forced to create fabrications, and he's involved in this all day. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, Yashuv l'zman min hazmanim, it won't be that long until he leaves his righteous ways, and he'll end up being a rasha gomer, a total wicked person. And explains the Sefer HaChinuch, the opposite is true as well. If you had a total rasha, an absolute evil person, and his whole desire was to do bad, but for whatever which reason he began keeping the Torah and mitzvahs, not l'shem shemayim, not because Hashem commanded, but for some ulterior motive, but he began keeping mitzvahs, immediately his heart would turn to good, and it wouldn't be long before he would be a tzaddik, because a man is affected by his actions. And if in fact I were the minister of propaganda, whether it be in Nazi Germany, whether it be for a king, the words that I spoke, the actions that I did would affect me. It would change my own beliefs, because Adam nifal kefi palosav, because a man is affected by his actions. And explains the Sefer HaChinuch, that is exactly why we have so many mitzvahs. Why is it that we're told over and over to say Shema? Why is it that we have 19 mitzvahs reminding us of the fact we left Mitzrayim? Because when a person does these things again and again and again and again, eventually they seep in, eventually they change the way he thinks, they change the way he feels, because a man is affected by his actions. And that's why we have so many different types of mitzvahs. And that's why we have so many mitzvahs that are repeated constantly on an ongoing and regular basis. Because through the constant repetition, by doing it time after time after time, eventually it changes the way we think, changes the way we feel, and we begin inculcating it into the essence of our being. But then the Sefer HaChinuch says something very, very profound and a bit frightening. He advises to choose your profession wisely, because since in fact a man is pulled after what he does, what you do in your 9-to-5 will greatly affect who you are. And he warns to be very, very careful in choosing what you do for a living, because it will affect you. And I'd like to share with you two examples, two applications of this concept that might be worth thinking about. The American judicial system is an adversarial system, meaning to say, in court of law, there are two lawyers, each one defending his client, and basically it's fight it out. Each one bring proof, each one counterproof, each one try to slug up the other one, try to disprove and prove the innocence or guilt of the other. Now, the basic theory behind this is that in the end, truth will prevail. You'll argue, I'll argue, and between the two of us, working our best for our client, whether our client is innocent or not doesn't matter, because in the end, truth will prevail, justice will be served, and in fact, the rationale for the system isn't totally absurd. It may not be Das Torah, it may not be the Torah's approach, but it's definitely not that absurd, because there is what to argue for the fact that if you're arguing a position very well and the equal opponent is arguing a position very well, the truth will come out, eventually justice will be served, and it's probably true that in the big picture scheme, it works. But I want you to imagine for a minute that you're a lawyer. And let's imagine for a minute you work for a firm. It happens to be the firm that you work for have a very single criteria by which they select their clients. The single criteria is if their clients are willing to pay their fee. And let's imagine for a minute the fee is, let's say, $1,000 an hour. Very prestigious law firm. You don't make that kind of money, but that's the billing rate. And let's imagine for a minute that you're working and one day your boss says to you, okay, you have a case and I want you to defend this case. And again, it's not your concern whether you think your client is innocent. If you think your client is guilty, you have to defend this client. And it turns out that the client is the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, and you're being paid to defend the tobacco industry against the claims that they knowingly hid evidence that smoking is dangerous to your health. Listen, it's your job. You got to do it. So you begin, and you start with the gathering of evidence. And then you start deposing witnesses and go through the whole process. Eventually, you get into the court and you start with the cross-examinations. And eventually, you stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, by now it should be clear to everyone here that my client is innocent. And in your mind, you fully know that your client is guilty of sin. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no possible way that my client could have known about these facts. And in your heart, you know fully well that your client had 15 different board meetings discussing these facts. Here's the point. Like it or not, you are being paid to lie. Whether the system is just or not is not the point. It could well be that for a Gentile nation, using such a system, they fulfill one of the seven mitzvahs b'nei noach, the obligation to establish courts, because there is a sense of justice, and it might well be that in general terms, justice prevails. But you right then are involved in a very clear example of lying, because you know fully well that your client is guilty of sin. And you know fully well that the words that are coming out of your mouth have no connection to the truth. And you're being paid to be a liar. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta defines honesty very simply. Not to say any words with your mouth that your heart knows not to be true. And when you get up there and say words that you fully know have no connection to truth, what you're doing is lying. And if you do that time after time, day after day, week after week, if that's your 9-to-5, it will have some major repercussions. You may not intend it to, you may not wish for it, but it will affect you and you will become a liar. Because the Sefer Chinuch explains to us, Adam nifal al pi polos, if you're affected by your actions. You can't say, I'm only doing it to make a living. It's justified in the long run. It may be true, but you are practicing something that is corrupting the essence of you and it will have its consequences. But it's not just the legal profession. And for the record, I'm not here to bash the legal profession because I know many very religious, very fine, very honest Jews who earn their livings as lawyers. But in the legal profession, you had better be very careful to either work for a firm or put yourself in a position where you don't have to be in that place. And there are plenty of ways to be a lawyer without having to lie. But you had better make sure that that's your job, because if part of your job is to lie, what's going to happen is you are going to pay the price. But again, it's not only the legal profession. Let's look at another one. There's something in the world called a salesman. So you work for a company, and your job is to sell product. You're being paid to accomplish one result. That is for the customer, the prospect, to take your product. And if the first question that comes across your mind when you're in front of the client is one and one question only, how can I get this client to take my product? Well, guess what? You might be putting yourself into an interesting predicament. You see, let's in fact say that you are there to convince your client that he needs your product when you know fully well he doesn't. What if you're there to convince this client that he's getting a great deal when you know fully well that he isn't? And what if you're there to convince your client that service after the sale, oh, we're the best at that, and you know fully well that your company is lousy in that department, well, guess what? You're spending your 9 to 5 lying, because in your heart you know it's not true. Your mouth is saying one thing, your heart is saying another, and you're corrupting your very nature. And again, I'm not here to bash the profession of selling. It is an honorable and proper profession when done honorably and properly. And the Mesillas Sharm explains to us what that is. And Sharon Akias explains that if you're going to speak to the heart of the purchaser with one thing in mind, convincing him how to get a yes, that's not necessarily honest. There's nothing wrong with presenting your product as it is in a proper way. There's certainly nothing wrong with if a customer needs your product but has difficulty making a decision, but you know that it's good for him, there's nothing wrong with winning him over. But you see, it has to be within the framework of being ethical and honest. And ethics and honest are determined in this case by one criteria. Does your heart and your mouth join together? If you know that it's good for the customer and you explain why, it's fine. If you know that your product is superior and you explain why, that's fine. But it's within that very small framework. And the minute you change out of it, then you are involved again in that same simple situation where you're training yourself in deviance, you're training yourself to lie, you're corrupting your nature. And by the way, even if you're not in law and you're not in sales, you should just know for the record, we're always involved in selling, every one of us. We're always selling our friends or our relatives or coworkers or children or spouses on ideas and things. And if you think about the fact that we are greatly affected by our actions, and the more often you repeat these actions, the more of an effect they have. And even if you know it's not true, and even if you don't mean it, and even if you don't want to do it, but you're doing it for some ulterior motive, it will affect you because we are shaped by our actions. And that's why there's so many mitzvahs. And in fact, I believe that's exactly the answer for this Nazakenin with Paro. It is definitely true that Paro had a real sense of appreciation and gratitude, and that's why he resisted. When his people said to him, we have to do something about this Jewish problem, how can we do that? We owe Yosef. He recognized the debt of gratitude. But after 3 months, he gave in. He said, I'll do what you want. And then he, as the monarch, as the reigning force, began implementing a lo yada es Yosef, acting as if he didn't know. From that point on, what he was doing was corrupting his nature by denying the good that they owned, that was owed to Yosef. By constantly being involved in the opposite of it, he was spending his 9 to 5 corrupting his nature. And Hashem says, I know what's going to happen. First you throw stones at the statue, then you throw stones at the king himself, because he's training himself in lack of appreciation, because he's training himself in ingratitude. He's going to do it day after day, week after week, until he's going to forget me. He's going to say, Lo Yada Hashem. And the reality is that what you do on an ongoing basis affects you greatly. Every action affects us, but the more often you repeat it, the more often you're involved in it, the greater influence it has upon you. And in fact, because Paro, even though it was unwillingly, and in a sense, he certainly had recognition of the good, but he was forced to act against that nature. But when he was forced to act against it, he did it time after time, day after day, week after week. He did it as his job, as his role as monarch. Eventually, it led to his corruption, led him to become a vastly different person. And I believe that this concept has relevance to us on a number of levels. I want you to imagine the following. Imagine there are two fellows sitting on a bus. And it's a long bus ride, but the bus makes many turns, goes through many stops, lights, etc., etc. And one man is sitting there calmly reading a newspaper, and the other one's agitated. And every time they make a turn, the guy is agitated, he's getting more nervous. Oh my goodness, there's a car. Oh my goodness, what if a truck comes up? And every time they go through a large thoroughfare, the agitated fellow gets more and more nervous, more, hey, watch out, careful, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, there's a car, whoa. And his friends sitting next to him, reading on calmly. Finally, at a certain point, the guy who was a little nervous and agitated turns to his friend. How could you sit there so calmly? Look at all these cars and trucks, and there could be an accident any minute. His friend looks at him and says, what do you mean? You see that guy? There's a bus driver. This is what he does for a living. He knows what he's doing. This is a mushel. You see, each of those people have a vastly different emotional experience. Each of them come off of that bus with a vastly different sensation and a different feeling. And I believe this is a very powerful mushel to what life is or what it could be. If a person lives his life with bitachon, knowing that Hashem is here, knowing that Hashem orchestrates my life, knowing that Hashem orchestrates the world, there's a powerful sense of trust, there's a sense of equanimity, of calm, of happiness. There's a driver to this bus. There's no random happenstances, no things just occurring. Hashem is here guiding. Hashem is here involved, and there's a sense of calm and a sense of equilibrium. If a person doesn't see Hashem in their world, oh my goodness, there are terrible, terrible things that can happen at any time. It's a very scary thing, this thing called living, this thing called the world. There are tragedies and there are events and people get killed and all types of bad things happen. And if Hashem is not active in your world, it is a very scary world. Two human beings can live through the same day. One can have a beautiful day. It's a wonderful day. Another one could be living wretched, fearful. And the difference in their experience is stark. And while it's a very important concept to work on and to understand bitachon, that's not my point. My point really is on a very different vein. The last shmooze, we discussed the fact that we human beings need to train ourselves to recognize the good. And that when we begin understanding the amount of good that we enjoy on a daily basis, I have hands with which to feel, legs with which to walk, I could stand up straight, I can see things and I hear things. And when I train myself to recognize the amount of good that I experience on a daily basis, it affects me tremendously. And what happens in a very interesting manner is that once I start training myself to recognize the good, I experience things differently. Now, it takes work. The first problem that we have is we fail to see it. We get so accustomed, we get so used to it, that we fail to even recognize the good. And we gave some exercises. One is you go to an old age home and you see what it's like to walk with a walker. And you watch a man. And you watch him for 10 minutes and then you put yourself in his place. In your mind's eye, imagine that it's you and you're walking with that walker and every pain, every stage, every step is more difficult. And then you feel your mobility. And you recognize what a bracha you have, that you can move. You imagine what it's like to be blind, Rachman Litzlan. And you spend a few minutes, maybe even put on a blindfold and walk around the house and feel what it's like not to see. And then you take the blindfold off and wow, it's astonishing. And you know what happens when you do this? When you do this, you start living in a world that's replete with wonder. When you start training yourself to recognize the good, you start seeing it all over. And the life that you live is exalted because all day long there are sights and there are sounds and there are feelings and there's constant things that you're nene from, that you benefit from, whether it be flavors, whether it be aromas, whether it be textures, whether it be just feeling happy. And when you train yourself to appreciate it, you're like the fellow on the bus who knows there's a driver and has a sense of equanimity, of calm. You live in a life that constantly showers you with bracha. You're constantly experiencing pleasures and enjoyments. And your life is vastly different than if you didn't train yourself to see it, to feel it, to recognize the bracha that we have. And the first job is to simply recognize it. First job is just to see those things that we have and to understand how much wisdom and forethought went into it, and to train ourselves to be sensitive to what we actually benefit from so that we can take the pleasures that Hashem wants us to take in the world. But even after you do that, there's still another blockage. And there's still another reason why it's difficult for us to feel and experience the amount of blessing and the amount of pleasures that Hashem wants us to. And I'll share with you what that is. I want you to imagine the following. Imagine that you come into your room, and in your room, on the desk, there's a present. And you see it's all wrapped up, and there's a gift card on it. You open the present, and you see it's a brand new iPad. And then you open the envelope, and you see it's from your friend. Dear David, I just want to tell you, you're a great friend. There's nothing I could ever do to repay you. Just want to say thanks. Signed, Maishi. Oh, my goodness. That's so sweet. That's great. Wow. I didn't need it, but that was so sweet. That is so nice. That's amazing. And obviously, you'd feel very appreciative, and you'd feel very good. I once gave this example to my high school class. I was a high school rebbe for many years. And one day, I was saying to the fellows, imagine that you were in your dorm room, and you saw such a gift, and you opened it up, and you saw it was from your roommate. What would you feel? You'd feel ecstatic. You'd feel so appreciative. And then I said to the guys as follows, gentlemen, don't you realize that you have been the recipient of just such a gift? When you were 10 years old, you had a birthday, and your parents bought you a birthday present, and you peeled off the wrapping. It might not have been an iPad. It might have been whatever. But to you, at that tender age of life, it was bigger than big. It was tremendous. And it wasn't just your 10th birthday that they bought you a present for. It was for your 8th birthday and your 9th and your 7th and your bar mitzvah. And what your parents have given to you, just in material costs, just in terms of attention, is mind-boggling. It's beyond description. They say that the cost of bringing up a child in our world is at least $250,000. It's probably a lot more in the frum world. But the point that I was trying to make to these young men was that everything that you are, your mother sat on the floor with you as a little kid to teach you how to read. When you were bleeding, when you thought all your blood was going to come out of your body, it was your father who put on a bandage. Your parents gave to you and gave to you, worried for you, helped you. What could you ever do to repay them? And I was trying to explain that the mitzvah of kibud av va'im is humanistic, is natural, that there's a sense within the human of how could I pay back? How could I somehow pay back my parents for all that they've done for me? And I spent 45 minutes on this concept, example after example after example. Shir was over. One of the fellows came over to me during recess and said, Rebbe, I get it. I know I sleep in their house. I know I wear their clothes. I eat the food. But that's their job. They have to do it. Why do I owe them anything? I wanted to grab this young man by the shirt collars and scream at him. It may be true that when you have a child, you have a responsibility to care for that child. But you are that child, and you are the recipient of that good. Their responsibility is their issue, but your responsibility is yours. You are the one who ate the food, wear the clothing, everything that you are is because of them, and you are the recipient of so much good. And it took me a long time to recognize the reason why this young man was saying it is because that's something that we all have. It's a sense of entitlement, the sense of, I don't want to owe anything to anyone. And even after we come to recognize the amount of bracha that we have, sometimes it's difficult to really own up to it because it's all owed to me. I once had a young man say to me, listen, Hashem didn't have to create me. He decided to create me. Now that he made me, obviously he's got to give me hands and legs and arms and all these things. I don't owe him anything. He decided to make me. He's got to give me these things. And that concept is perverse. And that concept is the opposite of truth. And that concept stems from one simple midah called gaiva, called arrogance. And it's only through arrogance that one can feel that. And it's only by deadening one's heart that they could sense it. And I'd like to share with you an exercise that I think may be very beneficial and may help us focus on this point. The Chovos Levavos asks an interesting question. He says, were you worthy to have been created? Imagine the following. Imagine asking yourself the following question. Before you were created, what did you do to be worthy so that Hashem should create you? Right? Before you were created, what did you do to be worthy to have been created? Well, obviously the answer is nothing, because before you were created, you couldn't have done anything because you weren't. And he explains that that's exactly the point. You were not created because you were worthy. You were not created because of anything that you did. You were created for one reason, because Hashem is a meitiv. Hashem is a giver. Hashem wants a share of his good. Hashem wants you to enjoy. The ultimate enjoyment in life is to experience closeness to Hashem. That's not in this world. It's in the world to come. But the reason you were put into existence is because Hashem loves you. Hashem wants to share with you. Hashem wants you to have all good. And when you understand that, you begin to understand life. You begin to understand that there is nothing, absolutely nothing that I'm entitled to. A, Hashem didn't have to create me. B, if Hashem did create me, he didn't have to give me hands and legs and arms and hearing and sense of sight. All of these things are brachas. All of these things are things that I don't have a right to demand. There's nothing that I can claim that makes me worthy. Hashem, you have to give me sight. You have to give me hearing. And it takes some maturity and takes a good, healthy dose of humility to recognize that every single one of these features are brachas that didn't have to be given to me, that were given to me as total chesed, and requires a lot of work. But if you do the work, you A, become aware of the good in the world, focus on things like sights and sounds, pay attention to flavors, and pay attention to the simple things that we forget. And then ask yourself the question, what did I do to be worthy of this? And if you'd like to really feel it, just imagine the following question. Rachmana l'tzlan, it shouldn't happen. But you lose a hand. You lose an arm. You lose a leg. How much money would you pay to get that back? Let's assume robotics get better and better. Eventually, they get to the $6 million man, and eventually they can replace a limb. Do you know how much money it would cost for the robotics, for the computer programming, to give you a hand, to give you a leg? The fortune of money that it would take to compute it, to design it, to put it onto you, it's beyond description. And that's simple robotics, like the hands, of the arms, something like a sense of hearing, something like a sense of sight, is priceless beyond any price. Mankind can't even begin imagining the type of sophistication that goes into it. And I was given this body, perfect. I was given this sense of hearing and sight and speech, not because I'm deserving of it, but I occupy this body that's so magnificent, and I enjoy a life of such bracha, not because I'm worthy, not because I'm entitled, not because of anything other than because Hashem wants me to enjoy this world, for me to grow, so eventually I could enjoy proximity to Hashem in the world to come. And when you spend a lot of time focusing on A, the amount of bracha, and get out of the habit of just going through the motions, when you begin focusing on really living on a higher plane, really enjoying the things that Hashem wants us to enjoy, like flavors and sights and sounds. And then you focus on the fact that all of these didn't have to be there. And Hashem invested so much wisdom and forethought for me to enjoy. And you begin reaching a very different sense, a very different perspective. And then the life that you lead is a different life. And then all day long, throughout your day, you're receiving benefits, you're enjoying, you're looking at sights and hearing sounds, you're experiencing things that are wondrous. And obviously, you have a tremendous sense of gratitude, an overwhelming sense of gratitude. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this Das Hakeinim. Paro, by nature, was a person who recognized the good, and he said to his people, I cannot pay back bad for good. We owe Yosef a debt. And that was him at stage one. But after 3 months, he came back to the throne and agreed to be the monarch that would enslave the Jewish people. And day after day, he did what he wanted to do to keep his position. And day after day, he corrupted his nature. Because as the Sefer Chinuch explains, Adam nifal kefi pulosav, we're greatly affected by our actions. The way we act affects the way we feel. That's why we have so many mitzvahs. That's why we have to do the mitzvahs so many times. Because when you do it and you do it and you do it again and again, it affects you. And if you were paid money to lie, steal, and cheat, even if you didn't want to, even if it was under the duress, under the threat of your life, if a king said you are to be the propaganda minister and you had no choice, they would have killed you otherwise, if you had to do that day after day, week after week, it would affect you slowly, you would change. And the Sefer Chinuch therefore advises us to choose what we do with our 9-to-5 very carefully. It could be ethical and honest within the context of the world's understanding, and it could be corrupting your nature, because if what you're doing is lying, if your heart says one thing and your lips say another, you're not acting honestly, and if you lie time after time, day after day, week after week, you will become a liar. And this applies to all of our relationships. It certainly applies to what we do for a living, but it's something that affects us in major, major ways. And it affects this thing called gratitude in a very real way as well. Because different people experience life in vastly different ways. Just like those two fellows on the bus. One is spending a half hour in Gehenna. He's nervous and he's tortured. And he gets off the bus and he's a mop. He's just wiped out. Because he just went through a half hour of a harrowing experience. But his friend is calm. His friend had a nice relaxing bus ride. When a person sees Hashem in their world, there's a driver to the bus. I'm not nervous. I'm not frightened. Life is calm. And so too, when you train yourself to recognize the bracha, when you train yourself to see the beauty in this world, you live a life that's enchanted. You live a life with constant pleasures. You live a life with constant benefit, and you're constantly seeing with wondrous eyes what Hashem has done for us. And you're constantly amazed by new flavors, by new tastes, by new sights, by new sounds. And your 9-to-5, and it's more than just your 9-to-5, your whole day is filled with experiencing pleasures that Hashem wants us to enjoy. Obviously, you enjoy this world much more. And there's a sense of gratitude and a sense of appreciation. And I'd like to close with just that thought. What would it be like? What would it be like if we actually trained ourselves to experience these things? And if we got rid of that sense of entitlement? And if I came to that humble recognition that I am not the master of my fate? I didn't decide to be born. I don't decide how long I'll live. I am a creation. Hashem is my creator. And there's nothing that Hashem had to do for me. He didn't have to create me. Didn't have to give me any of the benefits. But I am the recipient of so much good. Not because I'm worthy, not because it's coming to me, but only for one reason, because Hashem is a meitiv, Hashem is a giver. Could you imagine if I worked on that, what my life would be like? I open my eyes in the morning and wow, I see things, colors, distance, objects. It's astonishing. Wow. And I could track. Oh my goodness, I could watch things as they move. And I could see depth. And I could see proximity. My hand. Wow. 88 muscles to control the delicate movements of my fingers. And I have sense of touch and sense of cold and hot and wet. This is amazing. And I move and wow. This is astonishing. And look what I see. I look out the window. My entire day would be spent enjoying pleasures. Every food that I ate, I would experience the tastes, the aromas, the textures, and I would look at sights all day long. And instead of living like a robot going through motions, I'd be living an exalted life. And that's what Hashem wants us to experience. But you have to work on it. And when you work on it, when you first realize the bracha, then realize we're not entitled, your life is different. Your experience is not plain. And your experience isn't ordinary. And you experience tremendous pleasures, tremendous benefits. You enjoy this world and you have a tremendous sense of appreciation, of gratitude to Hashem. You sing out praise and you accomplish your purpose in creation. You grow, you become closer to Hashem. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, and the ability to put this into practice.